Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. We're plunging into the developments of the 1850s, and this is episode 177. In numerology, the digits 1 and 7 are significant. 1 represents new beginnings and leadership, while 7 is associated with spirituality and introspection. So it's no mistake that this episode probes spirituality and introspection and leadership. Not that I necessarily ascribe to the tenets of numerology, but it's a useful way into a sensitive subject. Time to gallop into the fray, as they say in our household. Over the past months, the story of this land here down south has featured happiness and craven madness, obsession, love, hate, blood, sweat, toil, and tears. And this is just a prologue. By mid-19th century, most of the game of the Cape from the north, the east, to the south had been shot out. The Amakhosa had been driven across the Fish River in 1812, out of the Cut River Valley in 1829, then right past the Kaiskamma River in 1847. None of the land they lived in west of the Kai was secure. No longer did the sons of the chiefs leave their dad's homesteads to seek out their own virgin territory, because there was none left. In the old days, when a man died, his homestead was burned down and vacated, whereas now, the new cattle enclosure was merely built back to back with the old one. Dwellings were clustered closer together. Not everyone could live near a river, unlike the century before. This was change, and drought took on calamitous forms. Before, the people could move to water. Now they were stuck on the landscape. So it was not surprising that, given the pressures of people and animals, the first great cattle lung sickness to be registered in this region followed hard on the land losses of the 1850 to 1853 period. The Amakhosa men were now labouring for the very people who had supplanted them, deprived of their means of subsistence and independence. Many Amakhosa had worked for the farmers and settlers before this time, and contrary to most reports, they were quite happy to do so, because they earned cash and left when they felt like it. The standard of living on these farms determined how long the workers remained, at least until this period of our history. The option of leaving at their own discretion eroded rapidly, as the access to cattle as wealth eroded. The smaller Xhosa land could no longer support the population. Even within that land, the men and women were now unconsciously working for the settlers by growing forage that they sold to the farmers and then making money to buy textiles and pots and pans and knives and axes and ploughs. Here is the crux of the contradiction in colonialism, that the people who bought the clothing preferred to buy this clothing than manufacture their skin carosses of yore, and yet by doing so, they were becoming dependent on the cash they made from their labour. As colonial intervention increased, a sea change in Xhosa politics was taking place. The petty rivalries of the various chiefs was encouraged by some of the colonial officials. The divide and rule precursor and the new governor, Sir Harry Smith, was particularly active in his attempts to divide the royal line of the Amakhosa and the commoners. This was not working. He tried to ban Lobola, then tried to usurp the power of the chiefs, but the commoners did not buy into the British plan. It was such a cynical move that the commoners, despite little access to power, preferred their chiefs, and an age of proper resistance to colonialism began. This is the period that saw the rise of leaders who would be recalled all the way through to the struggle period during apartheid. Names like Hintsa, Sarili, Nhlambe, Tungwa, Maqoma, Tjali, Sandile. I mentioned last episode about the perfidious nature of British law in the new territory called British Kaffraria, annexed to the Cape and run under military rule, where Smith's officers exercised arbitrary justice at their own discretion. Punishment was fines and flogging up to 100 lashes, or hanging for serious offences. Apart from the new English settlements of King Williamstown and East London, the whole territory was occupied by the Xhosa, divided into counties like England, each with a fanciful English name. So Sandile ruled from York, Patu from Bedford, Imhala ruled from that well-known British Kaffraria town of Cambridge. A census was taken so that taxation could begin in earnest, watched by the Amakhosa chiefs in alarm and despair. Henry Calderwood, the missionary-turned-government official, believed that the devastation of drought and the effect of the previous War of the Axe was actually good news.
"There is indeed great suffering in Khoisaland," he wrote optimistically, "and the opportunity should not be lost of scattering the people far into the colony, where they can find food and be useful." The fact that many of these people were children under 10 didn't faze Calderwood, because the magistrates jotted down their descriptions as youths in official dispatches, such as Commissioner McLean, for example. If you remember Ordinance 49 of 1828, you'll also remember it gave the Xhosa passes to seek work, enabling them to squat on settler farms, and also enabled them to move from farm to farm with relative ease. They built little shelters, then moved on when required. The farmer didn't complain, and the Xhosa worker felt they had some independence. However, a new ordinance had found its way onto the law books, Ordinance 3 of 1848, which repealed some of the rules of Ordinance 49. This turned the Xhosa and the Khoisan and others labouring on the farms into indentured labour. Whereas some of the Xhosa parents had initially supported the idea of their little sons and daughters heading off to the Cape after 1828, after 1848 they changed their minds. In response to their reluctance to support the shift, Calderwood and Smith suggested the parents should move with their children if they were so unhappy with the latest payment scheme. Charles Brownlee, the man brought up at the Xhosa, was particularly successful in convincing whole families to go work in the most arid places like Beaufort West. It had taken him a scant 4 days to find 180 servants to head off there, despite it being regarded as unpleasantly dry. Brownlee was thinking strategically. He specifically targeted Xhosa families in the run-up to the harvest in November, because before then they'd be hungry, and afterwards they would have food, and thus would have less motivation to go and work. Last episode, I mentioned the matter of the Irish convicts, 300, who were sent aboard the ship named Neptune, and who were forced to remain on board at Simon's Bay while the Cape residents mobilized against the idea of accepting convicts as labourers. The Neptune was eventually sent on her way with echoes of the angry assemblies in Cape Town, rejecting the government as arbitrary. London's idea of a penal settlement in the Cape had been met by a broadside of settler action. The Neptune was boycotted as it swung at anchor in Simon's Bay while the British government decided what to do. First, they thought of setting up a penal colony along the Namibian coast, then finally settled on a place called Botany Bay in what is now Sydney, Australia. Send the Irish there, whether the early Australians cared or not. As I've said before, South Africans and Australians have a very long history of joint immigration and immigration. Then Commissioner McLean sat down in 1850 to write a report about an incident that he regarded as trivial. It is part of South Africa's history and part of our diversity that something of significance that happens to one group appears insignificant to another. And I'm not talking about race, necessarily. So McLean wrote that, "I have the honour to report that Umlanjeni of Umkhai's tribe and location has lately revived the witch doctoring craft, and great numbers have attended his meetings." McLean duly continued, "I ordered him to appear before me, also his father Kala, at whose kraal Umlanjeni had erected several witchcraft poles. Both parties failed to appear. I therefore ordered the 2nd Division Police to apprehend them and to seize 2 head of cattle for their disturbance." Umlanjeni was not a man to be trifled with, despite McLean's brief, almost laconic note. We spent much of last episode hearing about the multiple churches and the role of religion in the Cape for a reason. As I've pointed out through this series, the grafting of two types of cosmology together, the ancient African legends and power ethos, with a salvation tale through the story of the cross, featured throughout our story of connection here in Southern Africa. Credo Mutua speaks of this power in his book Indaba My Children. Makoma summed up part of this when he spoke with frustration to missionary James Lang, who was sympathetic to the Amakosa ways. "We learn," said Makoma. "The English don't learn. Where are the English who learn?" He was referring to the miscommunication and disconnect between the officials and the majority of the people they were overseeing. The English were stubbornly refusing to learn about the customs of the people. They found the Amakosa life, their unselfconscious sensuality, permanently in conflict with the ways of the urban European. The authorities had tried to ban the red ochre, so beloved of the Amakosa and the Khoikhoi, and even the sand, because this was spread naked upon the skin, painted on the body. While the Khoisan appreciated trousers and textiles, because they really are easier to wear than skins, The missionaries wanted the Xhosa to wear the trousers and textiles for puritanical reasons. Nothing makes a zealous and pious person more nauseous than the flashing of a bit of skin. Censors during apartheid had no problem with pools of blood in Skopskiet and Donner movies, but as soon as the pernicious aureole appeared, they'd swoon with horror. An important note here, the missionaries of South Africa up to the end of the mid-19th century were either from dissident British religious groups or German Lutheran ones. The first Roman Catholics only began to show interest in missionary work in Southern Africa in 1848, but up to now it was the militant evangelicalism of nonconformist Britain that had shaped the Amaxhosa view of Christianity. It was only later that the more pragmatic Catholic missionaries rocked up. Not well known these days, but the missionaries who had dominated the early work were of the flaming, Bible-punching, eternal hellfire-preaching evangelical type. Fundamentalists castigating the Amaxhosa about damnation for the unsaved. With regards to Amaxhosa culture, well, it was sloth and idleness characterized by abominable heathenish practices, which needed to be uprooted and destroyed. They were harshly intolerant in how they approached the people they believed could teach them nothing. It was the Amaxhosa who had to do all the learning. At the same time, it is not true that all the missionaries were as tone-deaf as this. It is also true that the Xhosa respected many while despising others. Missionaries like James Reed were evangelicals, but he married into the Khoisan and lived as an indigenous African. He was learning while teaching. All missionaries, however, were united in their dislike of Amaxhosa rainmakers and diviners, witchcraft, the ceremonies of circumcision, polygamy, lobola. While the cultural importance of lobola was set aside to some extent, the men and women they called witch doctors were fixed enemies, implacable enemies. The nasty manner in which the Amaxhosa put to death those who'd been smelled out as witches, which involved the unfortunate victim being staked out and stones cooked on the white-hot fire spread upon their bodies, or the others who were staked out over ants' nests to be eaten slowly over days, a week, or perhaps two. On the other hand, the Amaxhosa viewed the British lashing and public hangings as reprehensible, for the Xhosa executing someone like this who was not a witch was simply murder. On the one hand, the Xhosa diviners tormented to death the witches, in inverted commas, by hot stone and ants. On the other hand, the missionaries saw that as medieval. What an ecclesiastical mess. Of course, in Britain and Europe, the smelling out of witches was almost an established sport. The long history of maleficium, where women were lynched or burnt alive at the stake. The lynching of witches in rural England continued until the late 19th century, by the way. So before anyone starts throwing stones, make sure you don't have a stained glass house, to bludgeon another proverb, and apologies. The missionaries said witchcraft did not actually exist, and then failed to detect a faint contradiction in their own warnings about fire and brimstone, an almost fatal contortion of logic. So picture the scene. There are the Amaxhosa, unself-conscious about their bodies, their sexual life, naked and demonstrating a wholly uninhibited attitude on these matters. On the other, the missionary, demanding veils and coverings, who thought a naked ankle was a version of the itsy-bitsy teeny-weeny polka-dot bikini. Sin upon sin, they screeched. It didn't help that much of their outrage was based on the Amaxhosa practice of sexual experience, which began at an early age, where lovemaking between young people was freely accepted, expressed openly in the explicit dances accompanying the rites of passage. What the missionaries failed to notice, or learn, is that the Amaxhosa had a very serious code for all of this, and so did most of the Bantu-speaking people they came across. These codes were as rigid as the Victorians themselves, but these English were not learning. Any loss of virginity was a disgrace to the Amaxhosa family, as it was to the English Victorian family. The seduction of a virgin was one of the most serious offences committed by any Xhosa boy or man. In the early days, hundreds of years before, it would have been a death sentence. By the 1800s, it was exile and a life of exclusion for the errant male. All the cattle of the boy and his family would be seized. Young girls received mentoring about how to have sex without penetration. The matrons, with their creative thoughts about how to excite passions lying together, mutual stimulation, for example, or external intercourse. This is a family channel, so not too much information, but you get the picture. Young girls were given detailed instructions about how to avoid losing their virginity and warned directly about being known as promiscuous. The ancient Amakosa system of Upuntlo gave the chief the right to raid virgins of a kraal for himself and his counselors, however. Sandile's father, Ngika, put a stop to this custom because the people hated it. But Sandile reinstated part of this system before the War of the Axe, saying it was the Amakosa chief's right and the missionaries had stopped it. Not quite true, but you know how propaganda and war work together. By 1850, a Xhosa man who impregnated a virgin or caused any pregnancy was compelled to either marry the girl or pay a huge fine to her relatives. I've spent a little time on this because we're entering the way of the shades. We must understand precisely how these things worked because coming down the line was Umlanjeni. There was no libidinous guilt of original sin, but there was a distinct concept of the laws of supreme beings and the hereafter, the blessings of the living derived from the spirits of the dead. Prosperity was linked to how vigilantly their spirits were looking after them. The living were the children of the dead, and as I said in an episode many, many months ago, these beliefs held advantages for the missionaries. The Amakosa believed in malevolent powers, the shades, but not the shades of Satan preached by the missionaries. It was confusing. A handful of converts lived around the mission stations, and the clash of traditions could be felt here. Polygamy was sexual indulgence, debasing Christian marriage. So, the taking of a second wife had fixed rules. Firstly, once the new wife arrived, the first wife, who was always preeminent, would train the new wife for at least a year. All other social relations outwardly were retained. Respect and dignity of life continued, and the first wife would retain her own house. All other wives were subordinate to the chief wife, but she would not interfere in the junior wives' houses. The concept of Lobola underlined just how little the English had learned. Among missionaries, the basic misconception was that the bride was bought with cattle or sold by her family. Lobola was the root and branch of Amakosa society. Every bit of personal and family growth is provided through the stability of the individual and therefore the family. The values of the entire society were bound up in how Lobola was handled, an alliance between families historically. The ikazi, or the cattle paid, was seen as the knot of the entire love between the two and of the marriage. When the girl leaves to go to her husband's kraal, something from that kraal must leave and go to her home. Therefore, everyone possesses something. An ikazi was distributed among several male relatives. The cattle could not be held exclusively by the girl's father. If some misfortune befell the girl's father, she could call up the debt from the other male members who got cattle in the deal, money in the bank. A woman with a dowry was considered as valued by her families, as in other cultures. It was also true, though, that if a girl who was not a virgin got married, she could expect a minimal ikazi, fewer cattle. Chastity was highly regarded. It's also true that the bride was given almost no say in marriage arrangements, just in case you think this is a wonderful concept. It is also true that a bride was given almost no say in marriage arrangements, similar to other cultures of this time, for example, the Norwegians and the French and other European nations. While in southern Africa, at least the metropolitan areas, a woman chooses her partner these days, that system has never been destroyed. Missionaries began to realize that Lobola was not going to disappear. When Maclean wrote his first report about British Kaffraria, dated 1st January 1851, he painted a rosy picture. Everyone was happy. The chiefs had transitioned to a new system quietly and passively. Justice was even-handed. Security was enjoyed by all. Farmers were talking about plentiful harvests, and wool was being shorn by the ton. So it was with great happiness that Earl Grey cut military costs in the colony. Smith had sent away 1,500 regulars while retaining 4,700 officers and men. Facing them, though, were over 35,000 Amakosa fighting men, if you combine the Timbu and the Tsaleka with the Larabi and the Ntlambe. Andries Stockenstroom was deeply unsettled about the deteriorating situation on the frontier as a result of Harry Smith's policies. Stockenstroom had been writing letters to Grey, but the old Dutch official suffered from an inability to write lucidly. His prose was pockmarked with endlessly long and recriminatory parenthetical clauses. His agitated mind further exacerbated this muddied comms, and Grey read the letters with exasperation. Stockenstroom was mired in personal backbiting, and Grey responded coldly to his flaming letters of warning. Pity about that, as you'll hear in coming episodes. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It helps elevate the visibility. And you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, sign up for my little newsletter there, and I'll also update this episode. Until next, goodbye.